Thank you, Tom. And indeed, this work came about as when I was busy with the organization of the quantitative finance program, and I couldn't do much of my regular research, so I spent my time reading orthogonal subjects. Well, not so orthogonal, but just divergent subjects from what I was doing, and became fascinated by the subject of crisis and bubbles and how economists have been modeling this and dealing with these issues of credit expansion. And really, this always started with one quote that I got from Charles Kindleberger's book on manias, panics, and crashes, where he analyzes the history of panics and bubbles and so on. And at some point, he, before introducing the work of Minsky, he says, there have been expansion of credit in history that didn't cause bubbles, but there hasn't been a single bubble that was not accompanied by a huge expansion of credit. So I said, well, okay, this is a strong statement and somebody needs to model this. So I can't believe that there is no proper mathematical modeling of that. So I started looking for it, and I found some, and I wanted to share with you today. So it's a little bit of what me, and so it's joint work with Bernardo, who's sitting there. And he's responsible for all the graphs and the movies and all the calculations, as typical of a PhD student. So my role is just to promote our ideas around, but all the work was done by him. So just to situate, I said, you know, how economists think about this. And I think there's the right way and there's the not so right way of thinking. So I will start with the not so right way. So this is the outline. I will review what people do in dynamic general equilibrium. So this is the workhorse of macroeconomics these days, how they treat this kind of problems. But see that Minsky, who was an economist active in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and I think Bill might talk about him a bit later because Bill knew Minsky personally, how Minsky would have different views on related problems. Then we'll go through what's called the Goodwin model, which is a two-dimensional model for modeling wages and employment. Then well, we've been calling the Keane model. Keane is Steve Keane is a Australian economist who did a lot of work in the 90s not so mainstream economics, but he's a bit of a rogue economist. His latest book is called Debunking Economics, so you can tell that, you know, most economists will not be very happy with his work, but I was, and I found very illuminating. So most of what we're doing is, if you like, crossing the I's and dotting the T's of Keane's work. And then see in the end how to introduce this phenomenon of Ponzi finance and the possible effects of government policy for stabilizing or not this system. So, but I promise I was going to talk a little bit about standard sort of macroeconomic views. So all the statements that I have here, I got from the introduction, so the preface of a book written by a distinguished economist, published by a distinguished publisher, I think it's Princeton University Press. So none of these statements are my interpretations of the theory. These are the things that they actually write as the strong points of this line of research. So what does a dynamic general equilibrium tries to achieve? To explain aggregate facts in the economy, so the level of employment and spending, GDP, and so on, using theories that have a strong micro foundation. So namely, they need to be based on what agents are doing and how agents make decisions and how they aggregate their decisions, and off comes the subject of macroeconomics. The reason for that escapes me. Why would you try to do something like that? But I will comment more about that later. But that's, you know, the flagship, you know, that's the main selling point. It's rigorous because it bases its results on strong micro foundations. You model all the collective decisions of all the agents in all possible states of the world at all times, rationally. I'm not going to use too many colors except for the graphs, but there is one word that needs to be in color there, which is that the variables are assumed to be in equilibrium. The starting point is in equilibrium. The only way in which the economy is not in equilibrium is when there is misinformation. Somebody is interpreting things incorrectly. And then as soon as they learn what the correct information is, the assumption is that they correct their actions. And that's very benign. You know, nobody says that people continue to be stupid on purpose. But then they make this strong leap that says, then obviously this returns to equilibrium. You assumed it was in equilibrium to begin with. Then there is some shock, some misinformation, some new technology, and we're going to hear about constructive and destructive shocks later on. But the adaptation to the shock is, well, we learn and then we return to equilibrium. But that's an assumption, just as strong as assuming that it was in equilibrium to begin with. The other assumption, and you know, I say this is not my interpretation, this is all written there, is that money is neutral in its effects on real variables. Money only affects price level. So the availability or not of money doesn't influence the true decisions for the equilibrium level of production, of employment, of consumption, and so on and so forth. In fact, they prove results. So money is introduced in this book on chapter 8 or something. So you do 7 chapters without dealing with money. And then later, it's only introduced to prove that it doesn't matter. So there are results, there are theorems called the hyper-neutrality of money and things like that. Uncertainty is also not that important. So about on chapter 12 of the book, they say, well, it might look like all that we did was deterministic and therefore subject to criticism of uncertainty. But look, it really doesn't matter. All you have to do is consider the expected value of these things, take away the risk premium, treat everything as if it was now deterministic by dealing with their expectations, and Bob's your anchor. You just continue the analysis. So again, uncertainty is introduced through the end of the book only to be shown to be irrelevant. Now, there are several ways of describing this, and because I'm being recorded, I'm going to refrain from using much strong words. But look, the idea that these variables will remain in equilibrium or return to equilibrium once they are disturbed have never been proved. And it's worse than that. So there were results. So this all came about in the... So everybody knows the existence results proved by Arrow and DeBrew in the 50s. And they were very important results showing that in full generality, you start with agents and you put their utilities, you put their endowments, and they exist in equilibrium. But the proof is not constructive. If you ever read this proof, it's a fixed-point proof. It's a set theoretical proof that shows the existence of the equilibrium. Now, every mathematician, when they look at something that is shown to exist, the second thing that you want to know is if it's the only one. And then they did some more work to prove uniqueness, and there are some positive and negative results. The negative is that, in general, you cannot prove uniqueness, but you can prove that there's a finite number of equilibrium points, so that's good enough. So finite equilibrium. And then the third thing that you want to know is if the equilibrium is stable. Now, there are more than one equilibrium. You could move from one to another, or you could never return. So the assumption that the economy stabilizes itself might not be valid. So how do you do that? Well, because the proof is not constructive, you need to put more structure in it. So the way they did was showing that if what's called the aggregate demand function satisfies some stronger requirements, so convexity and so on, then the equilibrium is stable. So it's a conditional proof. But then all sorts of clever economists, including DeBrew himself, roll up their sleeves and say, okay, now let's prove that the demand function can be assumed to be of this form. And then there are negative results. So these were discovered in the 80s. They go under the name of the Sonnenschein Mantel DeBrew theorems. And they're extremely powerful and general theorems that show that even if you assume that individuals behave very, 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 very well behaved, when you aggregate their behavior, the aggregate demand function doesn't need to satisfy any further assumption other than being homogeneous and smooth, and the demand at zero is zero. And with those things, you cannot prove anything. You cannot prove stability with that. And then I said, oh, okay, well, maybe the conditions of the Sonnenschein Mantel de Brou are too general. You know, the point is that the agents can be too different. So if there is some homogeneity or close to homogeneity in the agents, then maybe we can prove that. And really the last nail in the coffin of this subject, Alan Kerman proved a result that shows that as long as you have differences in the endowments of the agents, and the number of the differences is more than the number of commodities in your economy. Now think of that mean. This is very very easy to satisfy. You know, 1 million agents, 100 commodities, you just need to have 100 of those agents with differences in endowment to guarantee that the demand function doesn't satisfy any stronger condition. So this is extremely destructive, and nobody in macroeconomics paid any attention. I mean, they did pay attention to it, but at the same time that the mathematical economists were proving those results, you know, the economists were like, oh, okay, let's wait until they establish this and let's make provisional assumptions. For example, a representative agent. Now, a representative agent immediately puts this problem under the carpet, because if there is a representative agent, then there is no aggregation problem. Then you can assume that the aggregate demand satisfies whatever condition you like. But all those papers should be read, you know, we assume there is a representative agent until these people sort out the aggregation problem and tell us what the representative agent is. But they never went back to it because the aggregation problem was not solved. Yes? Huh? So the representative agent is the thing that, you know, you instead of having all sorts of agents with heterogeneous utilities, you say that there is a utility, there is a sort of a weighted average of all the utilities, and the endowment also is a weighted average of the endowment. Yes, but without any proof that this mean field model can arise from the individual interactions. There is absolutely no proof, and in fact, the Sonnenschein-Mantel de Brou theorem is a negative result showing that, in general, you cannot have a representative agent. Okay? So the word fraud comes to mind, but I'm not going to use it. Let's just say sloppiness, you know, that these dynamic, stochastic, general equilibrium people adopted, and then they write books and go on giving policy advice. But let's not waste too much time on this. And if you don't believe me, you know, go and read the papers. Go and read the, it's a mathematical result. Interpret the way you like. But I'm just going to put up a few voices of discontent just to validate, you know, have some fun at the general equilibrium people. So this is Morishima in 84. If economists successfully devise a correct general equilibrium model, should it lack the institutional backing to realize the equilibrium, namely how this thing gets aggregated, then it will amount to no more than a utopian state of affairs which bears no relation whatsoever to the real economy. Alan Kerman, the guy I mentioned before for one of the results, he says the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium is empty in the sense that one cannot expect it to house the elements of a scientific theory because it cannot be contradicted. It makes predictions that you cannot possibly invalidate because the assumptions are too strong. Unless you throw away all the assumptions, you cannot invalidate the theory. One capable of producing empirically falsifiable propositions. Kenneth Arrow himself, if you needed more confirmations, in 86, after the Sonnenschein, the Mantel de Brou theorems, he just said, okay, enough is enough. In the aggregate, the hypothesis of rational behavior has, in general, no implication. So the whole point of basing the macroeconomics into solid micro foundations is empty, as Kerman would say, even if you assume that agents behave rationally. I'm not even talking about behavioral finance or, you know, all the points that are being made. The utility theory doesn't even represent any individual agent. Assume that, you still cannot get a sensible macroeconomic theory out of that. And then Robert Solow, I'm going to use a couple more of his remarks later, says, you know, he's criticizing general equilibrium. He says, maybe there is in human nature a deep-seated perverse pleasure in adopting and defining a whole counterintuitive doctrine that leaves the uninitiated peasant wondering what planet he or she is on. You start reading those papers, and you really have to ask yourself what planet you're on. But they come with such a jargon and seemingly sophisticated mathematics, because then when they say, you know, this is sophisticated math, you just go in it, and once you remove the, you know, strong assumptions, there's not much left, and the rest is data fitting. And it goes under the name of calibration, which is a dirty word in macroeconomics, which just means you do the model, you put parameters there, and then you simulate the hell out of that, and you do a method of moments to match the moments of whatever variables you have to whatever variables your model predicts. So I was reading some matching, you know, fitting of the 2008 economic crisis to dynamic stochastic general equilibrium, and they had something like 14 variables and 23 independent shocks. Now, you give me 14 variables and 23 independent shocks, and I can fit whatever you have to whatever model I can come up with. So, you know, the statement that it's an empty theory becomes more and more clear. Robert Solow has another quote that I didn't put there, which says that, you know, people... Bob Lucas complained that Solow never takes the technicalities of dynamic stochastic general equilibrium into consideration. And then they asked Solow what he thinks about that. I said, look, if somebody comes to you and says that they are Napoleon Bonaparte, the last thing you want is to enter into a technical discussion about the Battle of Austerlitz. So if something looks crazy, it's because it is crazy, and you don't validate it by going into a technical discussion. But there are different ways of doing this. So Minsky provided a completely alternative interpretation of all these things, which happens to take into consideration several real facts. For example, that there is money, and money is not neutral. You know, general equilibrium is based on the barter paradigm, that money, the only reason for money to exist is that I don't need to just exchange goods. I don't need a double coincidence of wants to do a transaction. We can do it through a medium of money. But in reality, money has a much more important role because you base your investment decisions on the availability of money that you have to fund those investments, and then you need to repay those investments based on the cash flows that your actual projects generated. And the intermediate, so there's an entire class which is not treated in dynamic stochastic general equilibrium, namely the financial system, not only money is neutral, but banks don't exist. Banks are not even part of the model. And, you know, trying to, I know that the economists are trying to push banking into dynamic stochastic general equilibrium. Well, good luck to them. But if you have hyper-neutrality of money, there's not much much more that you can do. But anyway, financial institutions are the intermediates that decide how these funds are allocated. And uncertainty is not something that you move away by taking expected values. Uncertainty is crucial because it bases, you know, it's what you have uncertain cash flows that need to validate the contracts that you made in the past. So there is time in here, and there is uncertainty that moves around in time. So Minsky concludes that an economy, that the economy is fundamentally cyclical, and each stage contains the elements that lead to the next stage. So, I mean, you just read that and you salivate as a mathematician, because that just, you know, it's there to be modeled as a system of interacting differential equations. So that's exactly what we do. But before we do, here's the whole picture of what Minsky called the financial instability hypothesis, and he called it like that just to piss off the market efficient hypothesis that was coming out at about the same time. So, oh yeah, you have a silly hypothesis, here's my hypothesis. So say the economy starts in a state where everybody's doing well, perhaps because it was just after a crisis. So people are conservative in their lending and then borrowing. So most projects succeed. You only borrow basically to pay for a shortfall into your cash flow. So you're not doing expansion or anything. So existing debt is easily validated. Because existing debt is validated, then you start to borrow more. Then you revalue the way these cash flows are going to come in the future. You put more probability to the positive outcomes and less probability to the negative outcomes. And then you borrow and invest, and it starts a phase of exponential growth into the available credit, which leads to a higher asset price, because it's very easy to see that if you're buying things with borrowed money, you're going to overbid on the fundamental value of the things that you're buying. Now, the financial instruments that don't have, you know, high yields they get devalued. So interest rates, they rise spontaneously in this kind of environment. And eventually, so this is what's called the euphoric economy. At this point, there enters this figure of the Ponzi financier, which is somebody who is just borrowing money to buy things in the expectation that it's going to sell those things at a higher price and then repay. So there's no, because you have an exponential growth in asset price, that this thing is going to continue. Eventually, this hits the possible viable business that you can do. So at that point, there is what's called there is just a shock. But because everybody is highly leveraged, a shock of 1% gets transmitted into 20% in your balance sheet. And then, you know, these Ponzi financiers, they now have to sell their assets. But because they have to sell their assets, now they put pressure, downward pressure in all the prices. And then the cycle starts, but then reverts into fire sales. So at that point, the euphoria becomes a panic. And his conclusion is that the stability, the very thing that made people start to borrow more, was tranquility in a world with a cyclical past and capitalist financial institutions is destabilizing. Very well. Now, so we have the story. We know what are the facts that we want to capture. So what is the mathematical model for it? So we start with this, which is called the Goodwin model. So Goodwin was an economist, Harvard economist when he proposed this. Then he moved to Cambridge. So in 1967, he has a five-page paper, extremely concise, with the following model. So here are the assumptions. So the first three are innocuous assumptions. So you have exponential growth in population, exponential growth in productivity. You can put any other growth there, but this will just make the constants come out easily. And then you make an assumption on the production function. So Y is total GDP. If you know about these things, you know, it could have constant elasticity of substitution and so on and so forth. But this is the simplest production function that you can think of, is where there are only two factors, capital and labor, and they are not substitutes. So capital is completely utilized to finance the production, and the level of production determines what the labor, what the employment is. So L is the employed population, and K is the level of capital. So this is called the Leontief production function. There's going to be an average wage rate. People don't have to actually have the same wage, but the wages, they rise and decrease on average by the same amount, yes, which we're going to see in a second. So the earning is the next high part. So those are the, nobody's talking about individual wages here. Now, the next two assumptions are what happened to wages and how investment grows. So this is the assumption that the rate of change of wages depend on employment. At times of high employment, workers demand higher wages. So this goes under the name of the Phillips curve. It was actually proposed by Phillips in terms of unemployment, but you just invert it, and that's the same thing. Now, the next one goes under the name of Say's law, and basically says that all wages are consumed, so there's no saving, and all profits are reinvested. That's the thing that we're going to generalize in a second. But for now, all wages are spent, and whatever the owners of the production, after they pay wages, so this is what's paid in wages, so it's the average wage times the number of workers. This is the total output. When you subtract one from the other, you have profit. So all profits are reinvested, and this is just depreciation. Now, these are the assumptions. Now you work out the differential equations of the model, because now there is a relation for, you know, Y is the lambda is the employment rate, so it's L over N. L depends on how much production there is, so it's Y over A. So those are the relations there, and you just differentiate, and now you have this equation. So what you see here is that, you know, the rate of change in lambda is something that depends on Y, and the rate of change in omega depends on lambda through this function phi. If you plug phi as a linear function there, you just see the predator-prey model, where workers play the role of the predator, and the employment rate plays the role of the prey. So this is the Lotka-Volterra system of differential equations. It's very easy to analyze the system. It has only two equilibria. The trivial equilibria is 0, 0, which is a saddle point. It's unstable, thank God. You know, 0, 0, you just move away from it. But then there's another equilibrium, the non-trivial equilibrium, which is obtained, so that's the saddle point. Now there's the non-trivial equilibrium, which is obtained by going back to those equations and then finding what's the value of omega and the value of lambda that make them equal to 0. So you find that there is an omega of equilibrium given by that, and there's a lambda of equilibrium given by that. But that equilibrium, that point, is non-hyperbolic, so you can't prove that they spiral towards it or they move away from it. What happens is that you have cycles around it. So now is the time I need to show you a movie, which is not playing here. So I'm just going to come out here for a second. And the movie is for the Goodwin model. So put it there, and this is how it moves around. So, for example, if you are in a region of when both lambda and omega are increasing, the economy is booming, people are hiring, and the wages are increasing as well. But at some point, the wages are so high that they need to lay off employees because profits are not good enough. So, you know, then employment decreases, and then employment decreases so much that then the employees start to accept wage cuts. And then everything decreases. But then after the factor on the laid off so many employees and the wages are so low, then they start hiring again because profit margins are better, and then the cycle starts again. That was just the movie, but you can see the... What am I doing? You can see the picture for the evolution of those variables. So it's pretty clear that they go in cycles of omega and lambda. So there you have your concept of endogenous business cycles, and the economy does grow. So here the red line is for growth. So this Goodwin called his paper growth cycle. So it's not that there is no growth, there is an overall growth in the economy, but the wages and employment move around like that. So he wanted to have a mathematical model for class struggle. Okay, but that's not good enough because it has you can have easy extensions of this model that destabilize it. So, for example, if you instead of having everything there was in real terms, so wages were real wages, not nominal wages, if you put inflation and then there's the illusion of salary increase by nominal salary increase, then that makes, so this was proved by Desai in 72, is that this equilibrium ceases to be non-hyperbolic, it actually becomes a stable point. Now, but you can do different things, for example, the other thing is that you can introduce some substitution between labor and capital, and that also stabilizes that equilibrium. Goodwin himself considered the case where productivity grows together with the increase of capital. So workers become more productive the more the capital is invested in the company. So that destabilizes the equilibrium. Now there's explosive oscillations. So all in all, this shows that this is what people in dynamical systems call structurally unstable. So it is dynamically stable if you maintain the model. So those cycles are always there. But if you perturb the model a little bit, then the qualitative features of the model change. So they say, well, the Goodwin model is not a good model for the economy because it's structurally unstable. And the second criticism is that it doesn't quite fit data well. So Solow did the test for the U.S. data, and he found, so you plot now employment and wages, and you do find the correct movement, the clockwise movement that I had there, but you don't find a whole cycle, and they sort of have sub-cycles. So Harvey did that in, there's no W here, it's just Harvey. Harvey analyzing the omega plot. Anyways, it's just Harvey. He did that for 10 different countries and obtained similar things. So I just put here two examples. So that's for France, and that's for Germany. So you know that it's trying to do the right movement, but clearly the model is too simple to capture everything that is going on. So anyways, if it is like that, structurally unstable, so we are now going to see what is the way to modify that, for one thing, to make it more realistic and also more stable towards modification. So the next model is going to be, instead of having all the profits reinvested, so this is the innovation that King introduced, you have a financial sector that funds investment. So now you don't need to invest only your profits, you can borrow to invest. So see that the K dot is the rate of new investment, is the increase in capital. So before, you only had the profit in there. Now you have something that is more than the profit. So it's an increase in function, presumably greater than one. So it's an increase in function of the profit that you observe. But now your profit has to take into account the fact that you pay back that to the bank. So now you need to look at your net profit. That's why, before it was just one minus omega, you just paid your workers. Now you need to pay the bank. So now you look at the rate of net profit, and if you only invested your net profit, then the debt would never increase, and that would be back to Say's law. But now you are going to invest more than your net profit when your net profit is high, and you're going to invest, you're going to do something different when your net profit is low. So now there is debt that increases at this rate. So this is the new investment, and this is what you had to pay the new investment. So observe that if kappa was the identity function, then there would be no net increase in debt. The level of debt would remain constant. But because you are investing more than your profits, kappa is more than the identity function, then this debt tends to increase when profits are high. But when profits are low, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Kappa, oh, there should be a dot in here. The dot is outside. It's there. Kappa is a function of 1 minus omega minus RD. And in fact, it's an exponential function. It's this. So the idea is that it shoots up when your profits are high, but it sort of plateaus when profits are low because people don't actually divest because that would be too unstable. They just, sit on the sidelines and do nothing when profits are low. So that's the zero investment function. Now, and then we choose the constants in a way that in the next slide you're going to understand. But there's a very mild things to impose on the constants. So what happens is now that you have a three-dimensional system. So now you have the equation for before for omega doesn't change. It's exactly the same. That was the Phillips curve. But now the equation for lambda does change. Before here, all that we had was 1 minus omega over nu. Now here's this nonlinear function that depends on d, which comes from this equation. Now d depends on everything else. So now this is a generalized predator-prey system, if you like. I couldn't find a good analogy for it because, you see, lambda is being predated by both omega and d has sort of a square term here but with a plus sign, so it's the opposite of what biologists would call a harvesting rate, so it's an anti-harvesting rate, if you like. But yeah, I gave up on trying to give interpretations of that. But that is the system, and now you need to analyze the system. Oh, well, now the first thing you do is look for the equilibrium of the system. So there is a good equilibrium. So what's the good equilibrium? Is the one where you just make this zero, just as before, so there's going to be an equilibrium rate for omega. You make this zero by choosing an equilibrium for this variable, 1 minus omega minus RD. Once, and it's easy to see what it is, it's going to be alpha plus beta plus delta times nu K inverse. It's going to be K inverse of this times nu. Then you plug that here, and then you can solve the equation for D. So that's a straightforward equilibrium. And I call that the good equilibrium. So you just find the pi by that equation that I just said. It's just a formula through the model parameters. And then you plug in and you see that omega is 1 minus pi minus RD of equilibrium. This is the lambda of equilibrium as in the Goodwin model. And this is the equilibrium level of that, which is also then a simple function of the parameters. Now you want to see, is this equilibrium, let's see if there are other equilibrium. Yes, there are, because you can put, omega equals zero here and lambda equals zero. So just for completeness, we analyze that. So you could have this case when you have a zero and zero, but then D needs to satisfy this equation. So that's another equilibrium point. There's a third equilibrium that is itself structurally unstable because it's the case where you obtain zero for omega, then lambda can be anything as long as pi is determined by the equilibrium formula for pi, and then you solve the equation for D. But now there are two formulas for D, and then the two need to give the same result, so it means that there needs to be an equation satisfied by the model parameters. Now, it's practically, it's ludicrous to impose that the parameters satisfy that. You just perturb one of them and it doesn't. So this equilibrium is not even worth analyzing because it is really structurally unstable. So let's analyze the other two equilibria. Okay, so here I will show what happens. So I'm going to skip the movie, but what happens in this movie is that they oscillate towards an equilibrium, and here's the picture. So that's the worker's share. It oscillates to its equilibrium value. This is the lambda. I don't know what's going on here. Bernardo, why is this greater than one? I think we... Oh, it's here. This is the axis for lambda. Sorry. And then it's less than 1. And then the worker's share is 1.3 up there. So it goes like that. And then this is the GDP increasing. So that was the good equilibrium. But there's something else that can happen. Namely, you now look at the equation for 1 over D and rewrite the system in terms of 1 over D. And now you see that 0, 0, 0 is an equilibrium point for that system. Now, 0, 0, 0 means 1 over D going to infinity. So that's 0, 0, and plus infinity for that. Now, that's also a movie that maybe I will show this movie, because now that's the one that diverges. So you see, you start moving around in omega and lambda, and you think that you are on a stable cycle, but that keeps increasing, and you have the feeling that something funny is going on here, because that keeps increasing and increasing. And really, if you let this move for a long time, what you see, none of this, what you actually see is this kind of picture, that, this is the omega, it oscillates, and then it shoots up, and then it goes to zero. The level of that is something that also eventually goes to zero. This is GDP. You have explosive growth in GDP until you crash. And then when you crash, you camp out an occupied Bay Street. You see, that's what the model predicts. But here, that's something else I wanted to show you. This is in the divergent model, what happens to omega, what happens to lambda, and what happens to the GDP. Okay, but just zoomed in a smaller scale. But there's not... Ah, no. I didn't get... I have the wrong graphs here, Bernardo. Is it this one? No. Sorry, I can't show you because we chose the wrong graphs for the presentation. But what the graph should show is the level of that. And the level of that you can more or less see from, I don't know where you can see. But if we had the right graph, you would see the level of that doing this. Boom, boom, boom. And sort of never going back to what it was before and just increasing again, which was what you're seeing in those cycles. Now, I got a little data for different countries, and this is what the level of debt does. Okay? Boom. Increases. So it kind of visually matches what goes on in reality. So we're going to do more data fitting on this to fit the model. The other thing that you see in real life is that, so this is a stunning picture that shows that employment, which is the inverse of unemployment, goes more or less correlated with change in debt. So one of the pictures that is not here as well, and we're going to see why they're not here, but would show if you differentiate the evolution of debt, you would find a more or less perfect correlation with the employment. So that goes to... Change in that goes together with employment, which is something that no dynamic stochastic general equilibrium can predict whatsoever. Okay, and it doesn't come out easily from the equation. It's just a fact of the evolution. Anyways, now for the local stability, what you find is that the good equilibrium is stable provided this relation happens. So you can check what that relation is. This equilibrium is unstable provided this happens, which is very likely because this is a level of profit which in most cases is higher than that, and K is an increase in function. The third equilibrium is strictly unstable, as I told you, so don't bother. But now this point, the 0, 0, 0, which was the 0, 0 plus infinity, happens to be a stable point for the other system. So the place where you end up camping at Bay Street is a stable point of your differential equation. So you gotta be worried about that. Provided this happens, but it's very easy for this to happen. As long as R is sufficiently large, or the rate at which you don't divest is sufficiently low, then that happens. Okay? This is what happens. This is the basin of convergence. So if you start anywhere there, then you converge to the stable good equilibrium. But if you start outside that, then you converge to the other stable equilibrium. And you see that the initial conditions for which you converge get reduced as the level of that gets increased. Now I'm just going to speed up. I started 5 minutes later, so I'm going to use the 5 minutes. So you see this type of good equilibrium here, no? This one, okay, it's good, but it doesn't capture Minsky's intuition that stability is destabilizing. You just see stability here. You're not seeing the destabilizing effect of stability. So we need to introduce more. And the ingredient that was missing there, but Keane also introduced that, so what we did was to put that more rigorously in the model, was the Ponzi financier. So the Ponzi financier is this guy who just observes the rate of increase of the economy, and when things go well, he starts to borrow, not for productive purposes, not to reinvest as capital, but just to buy capital assets, just to speculate. So how do you do that in your system? You do it by hand, and you, here, you put an extra term in the evolution of debt, so there is some people that are just borrowing, so increasing the debt level just to buy assets at price P. And the price of the assets are increasing according to the increase rate in the economy itself. So this is the increase rate of the economy, and that's a function of the growth rate in the economy. So you put that there. Now this is now a four-dimensional system. There's an extra equation for the Ponzi financing. And what you see is that now there is still a finite equilibrium, but this equilibrium is now typically unstable, so it does the effect that Minsky wanted of destabilizing. And worse than that, you now look for the extended system and you also do the change of variables, and now you have a plus infinity for that and minus infinity for the Ponzi price, and a plus infinity and plus infinity. Now this clearly doesn't make sense because this is a disposable asset, so you're going to dispose it way before it gets to minus infinity. But the point is that, again, the plus infinity is a stable equilibrium. So it has some attraction around it that you need to have your initial conditions starting away from it. In particular, if you test the model now with the same parameters for which the reduced model converged to the stable equilibrium, this converges to the to the infinite equilibrium, the stable infinite one. So in other words, this is what happened if you had no speculation. That's what the debt ratio goes. It goes to a finite value. With the speculation, then it just explodes. Okay, this is the speculation as a fraction of GDP. It goes to, you know, cycles like that, and eventually goes to go. Well, no, I think this continues to explode because we're now at the point where this will go to infinity. And then finally, in my last 2 minutes, so the other thing that Minsky would say is that there are natural ways that government have actually used to prevent economies from falling into this recession equilibrium, which is just spend when the private sector is not spending, and taxing the profits of the private sector. Now, the taxing effect, if you don't like taxes, you're a Tea Party, you probably won't like regulation either, but too bad, because, you know, these new proposals, Basel III and so on, it's all about counter-cyclical capital reserves. And a counter-cyclical capital reserve does exactly the effect that when profits are going high, you say that you can't really lend those profits. The banks need to hold reserves in those good times. And this is the government spending that now, when employment is high, low, so when unemployment is high, the government is going to come in and employ people to dig holes and then fill them up again. So now you create two new variables in your system, G and T. Now there's a new level of profit which it takes into account, you know, government spending actually increases profits in the private sector. And Minsky analyzes that in several of his papers, situations where there was a decrease in profits without government spending, and then the government steps in and the capitalists actually make more profit, minus the taxation. So I think Bill is going to talk a bit about that later, the big state capitalism intervening here to stabilize the economy. Now you have a five, Now you have a five-dimensional system. Now we haven't analyzed all possible equilibria. We just simulated a couple of cases, in particular the cases where it did went to an explosive death before. The effect of the government spending and taxation, it stabilizes it, and it stabilizes in a cute way. This is a transitional phase. You know, the system still doesn't know what it's doing. But once it gets to this phase, you see, it's those are bounded fluctuations. It fluctuates. So now there's all possibilities. Five-dimensional is huge, right? So there are all possibilities for chaotic dynamics and strange attractors and so on and so forth. But they are overall bounded. You don't have this explosive dash. And this, the last picture, is the trajectory. So after this weird phase here, what the trajectory is actually going end up doing is sort of this strange attractor there, which doesn't look too different from those some of the graphs that I showed you in the beginning. So now I'm going to finish with some concluding thoughts. Oh, next steps is to model prices intrinsically, not just put the Ponzi financier as an external agent in here. We can do noise, we can do a stochastic theory for dynamical systems. I mean, one can, I don't know if we can, and then calibrate the data. So I leave you with two thoughts. What does the model do? So Solow, also in a paper reviewing the Goodwin model, he says, you know, the true test of a simple model like this is whether it helps us to make sense of the world. Marx was, of course, dead wrong about this. We have changed the world in all sorts of ways with mixed results. The point is to interpret it, is to know how you are affecting and in which ways you are affecting the world. And now I found this recently, and I knew that Bill was going to talk about Schumpeter. And so this is a model for cycles, and Schumpeter had a particular affinity for cycles. And so I end with this quote. He says, "Cycles are not, like tonsils, separable things that might be treated by themselves, but are, like the beat of the heart, of the essence of the organism that displays them." And that's it.